Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, a range of progressive people will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences from Cuba, Nepal, Senegal, and Britain that are too often missed by mainstream media. This week, we're asking, how does your garden grow? To stop starvation, to combat climate change, and to create more harmony. I'm Chris Richards, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague David Ransom, who, like me, is a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine. David's latest magazine is about permaculture. So what gems have you been digging up for us, David?
Gems that I had no idea were there, really, because I had no idea what permaculture was. Mm. But a lot of positive things about what most of us, anybody really, can do for themselves in the face of what sometimes seem like rather overwhelming odds.
So tell us about the principles behind permaculture, David. First, what about the name?
Well, originally it was an illusion of permanent agriculture, and it did very much start off as a way of looking at the way we produce food, and it still is largely that. But over the years it's gradually evolved towards being more about permanent culture, really, because obviously food growing and agriculture only exists in a wider social context, and these days people who are interested in permaculture are interested in all of those things: urban design, architecture, education, a whole range of things other than simply how we grow food.
So you've no doubt been auditing your home and your office as a result of your contact with permaculture. How did you stack up?
Better than I would have done a little while ago, mostly because I'm getting a bit old now and I'm facing retirement, so facing quite a severe reduction in my income. And that's the problem of consumption that we all face, that actually how much we consume rather depends on how much we earn. So I've had to do something rather drastic to try and cut back what I consume. And I've moved onto a Dutch barge on a river. And that's made me think a lot harder about the things I use, and particularly energy and what I produce, and it's had quite a remarkable impact on my life one way or another. That was before I thought about permaculture, but permaculture has been extremely useful in making me think about it a little more systematically.
In what way?
Well, it uses... It's hard to say. I have no sense of design. You know, I do one thing or another and this seems like a good idea, or that seems like a good idea, or this works and that doesn't. And what permaculture has done is give me some kind of overall framework to try and make sense of it all, some sense of design, and I hesitate to use the phrase intelligent design, but something like that, and helps me to put things in context. What I did once I was starting doing this magazine was I got a permaculture designer down to the barge, and the barge itself has no mains electricity or any kind of basic utilities. And it's also moored to a big 3-hectare site. There are several of us moored there. And it's sort of rather overwhelming. So when this permaculture designer came down, he started seeing all sorts of possibilities about how we could use the trees, how we could use... Certainly, I hadn't even thought of fishing. That seems like a fairly obvious thing to think of. since it's on a river, and there are plenty of fish in there. I've just never fished in my life before. How I could maximise my input, or what I get out of the insulation on the barge, by putting actually a raised bed on top of it, which would help with the insulation of the barge and also help to grow things as well. I have to worry a little bit about how stable the barge would remain as a result. But perhaps more than anything, because there's a little community of us of about 20 there, it's got us talking about how we use the site. Like, we've got chickens roaming around it at the moment. We don't grow a great deal of fruit, we have organic beds and things like that, but how we relate that to the way we compost things and keep up the fertility of the soil, and generally how we make the whole thing more productive, and it's given a kind of framework for us to discuss it at any rate. I mean, we don't necessarily do everything the designer suggests, and some people are more sceptical than others, but it's sort of become a kind of political issue where I live, and that's been really helpful.
Because looking is what it sounds like it is partly about, David, just opening your eyes up to the possibility of what lays in front of you, just actually taking an audit of what is around and adapting the very environment around you to positives.
Yeah, indeed so. And I know it'll probably sound a bit strange to a lot of people listening to this, living on a barge, it seems like a bit bizarre, but actually most of the work I did on this magazine was in London, Bristol, big cities, what people are doing there. You know, anything from what you can do on a balcony or the smallest bit of space to what we call in Britain allotments, plots of land that you actually have a right to in this country to grow food on and that have mostly been neglected. So it really does pose a major challenge to almost anyone who thinks there's not much they can do. There's really something that almost anyone can do wherever they live.
I'm struck by your example of a garden on top of the roof of a barge because it reminds me of what I've been reading about Cuba. Cubans were asked to audit their homes when their country was hit by food shortages and gave practical reality to permaculture's principles. Australian permaculturist Pam Morgan was there helping to make Cuba's earth edible, particularly in the cities. How did they do it, Pam?
They had necessity, so that always helps as a stimulation. The food shortage came about as a result of the collapse of the Soviet bloc because Cuba had become very dependent on trade with the Soviet bloc, and they were exporting their sugar and tobacco. And in fact, buying in most of their food was imported. And so when these trade agreements collapsed, it was actually in the space of a year, but it was pretty quick, they lost 80% of their imports for agriculture, so that's fertilisers and fuels. They lost 50% of their food imports, and they lost 30% of their own food production. So all of a sudden, there was massive shortages in every area. And if they could grow food in the country, they often couldn't transport it to the city, they just didn't have the fuel. And at the same time, in the cities, the rubbish was piling up because all of those systems collapsed without the fuel to run the trucks to take the garbage away. So there are a whole lot of things happening at once. The first thing that happened, and that was not a permaculture action, it was actually the government brought all agricultural research to work on this problem. And so the first thing that was done is that they brought production close to people. So that's where the whole urban agriculture thing started. And originally that was for self-provisioning for households. So people in workplaces, first of all, workplaces were given access to land, and some of the workers who were underemployed because, again, the factories were running at a low level of production because of lack of fuel. It all ties in together.
Absolutely.
Some of the workers would actually grow the food for the workers' lunches. And then it went on to become a national call, almost like a Dig for Victory or, you know, those wartime campaigns, that for Cuba to retain its political independence, they had to overcome this shortage of food and become a food sovereign nation. So they really weren't going to depend on anyone else. They did it just by looking at all the potential in the city. Now, for some people, it was as simple as having a space outside their door where they could have a couple of pots to grow the herbs that you might need at night if the kids got an earache, or, you know, it was this sort of immediate needs to be met. For others, it was really then looking at that little unused space where you left your bicycle or whatever and thinking that also can be brought into production. And what we always looked at there were things like wall spaces, the vertical spaces, as well as the ground level. I mean, it's gone through a lot of phases since then. There's currently a campaign in Cuba, which is an accord between the National Network of Community Houses and the Ministry of Agriculture to have 2,000 new balcony and rooftop gardens. It's really quite a big and public thing.
And what are they growing on there, Pam? And I'm interested in the whole concept of what this looks like. What is being grown on the rooftops? What is being grown on the vertical walls?
Well, lots of climbing plants, of course, and fruit trees and things like that can go up against a wall. But the concept is more that you look at the space around you where sunlight will fall. The approach we always took, and it is a permaculture approach, you can do a lot about changing the soil or growing soil, but you can't change the amount of sunlight that's coming in. So what you look at, first of all, is when you talk about doing an audit, we would do an assessment of the microclimate. Where does the sun fall? What possibilities are there here? And so you do climbing plants or trees in places where you had a vertical space that received sunlight. The main things grown in the city are the perishable items, the things that are good to harvest fresh. It also is great to have it close by because you can do without the refrigeration, which is a really big part of home energy use.
Yes.
But anyway, we'll go back to what it looks like. I guess you wouldn't see it as a whole lot more green than around here, except most of the plants, or a good proportion of the plants, would be edible.
And it's smart. You were talking about permaculture and, for instance, oil supplies. How can permaculture help a diminishing oil supply?
Well, I think that one of the first thing of growing food close to where it's going to be eaten is a real basic. But I think that has another aspect too, which is you use the wastes of human living close to where it's produced as well. So it's closing those cycles so that you don't get big transport infrastructure intervening in that. That's one of your energy uses. Lots of other things, growing your own manures or fertilisers, growing your own inputs into the garden so that in a garden you would allocate space not only to produce food, certainly to have composting, but even creating more fertiliser, as in growing something to feed to the chooks and using the chook manure into the worm farm and into that sort of cyclic thing that you're trying to build up with permaculture.
I'd like to bring David Ransom into our conversation now, Pam. I'm thinking, as Pam's talking, David, some of this stuff is quite political, isn't it? I'm thinking about growing food close to urban areas. I wonder what the supermarkets would think about that.
Well, I'm sure they would say, what a good idea on the surface, and underneath be extremely unhappy about it, because, I mean, I do think what permaculture does represent is potentially, in the longer run, and hopefully sooner rather than later, a threat to the way those distribution systems operate. And either they rethink about it or things are going to have to change.
Hmm. Pam, in terms of oil, what about oil replacements? Were things like cooking oil or anything like that considered by the people in Cuba?
No, I think at the time they were just quite desperate for food. You know, that was the first stage of things. But I think now that that crisis has gone, there's a lot more time to experiment with other levels of what you can do. But one of the things that has happened is that the Cuban diet's changed. And the need for oil, that dependence on pork fat that was there before, has now gone to a large extent, and people are eating a lot more vegetables. There's been quite major changes in the health of Cuban people because of these dietary changes, and in the health of Cuban people because they're doing more exercise and walking and riding bikes and all sorts of other things associated with the oil shortage. They have an excellent level of research, and so now that urban agriculture has become part of their lives, they've become very efficient at doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So the level of production, for example, since urban agriculture first started up until now, they've become about 10 times more effective in producing food in the city, which is freeing up more and more space for more of these other more experimental things, increasing the number of fruit trees and nut trees and whatever in the city.
And what changes needed to be made to the education structure to do this?
Well, they didn't change the education structure, but what's happened now is that there's 140,000 jobs created in urban agriculture in Cuba. So it's a career path. People can decide that they want to work in urban agriculture and go to university, and that's what they do.
David, I'm wondering what your observations are about how we'd need to change the education structure to make people more aware of their environment and how it can work in with, for instance, bringing down carbon emissions.
Well, I was struck by Pam's talk. There was one thing that occurred to me which is encouraging, which I didn't know, because, in fact, with the oil deals with Venezuela, I guess the immediate crisis is over, and I was not altogether certain how Cubans were actually dealing with that, but it sounds very encouraging. On the education issue more generally, it's quite interesting that in Africa there's been quite a heavy emphasis where permaculture's developed there on the school system and using playgrounds and the like to actually grow food to help with the nutrition of children there. And at the same time, that, of course, helps with the education system itself, so that skills that perhaps are getting lost amongst people in terms of how to cultivate things are actually much more part of the educational curriculum in Africa than they were. So that's encouraging.
How widespread is permaculture in Africa?
Well, it's in its early stages, I think it has to be said. And of course, the really interesting thing at a sort of international level about permaculture is that it's very much less a kind of system, a bright idea that gets carried off to Africa or elsewhere or Latin America as an entirely new invention of the West or something that goes in with aid money and is going to solve all their problems. It's much more responsive than that to indigenous wisdom and what people know about their own environments and supportive of that. And that is a major difference, I think, in the way that people who know about permaculture approach issues of food production and wider issues of design as well. Mm. So it's quite active in South Africa. It's quite active even now, despite all the difficulties, and that in itself is quite interesting, in Zimbabwe. And generally speaking, I think it stands pretty good chances of becoming much more familiar in Africa than it is at the moment.
Pam, I was struck by the fact that Australian permaculturists were invited to Cuba. How so?
Well, for a start, this is where permaculture started. It's an Australian concept, so obviously there was a lot more knowledge about it here. But what happened is that there's always been an annual brigade to Cuba by the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society to help with the citrus harvest, and it's also an educational tour. And in the middle of the food crisis, I think it was about 93 or 94, a couple of people went on that brigade who were familiar with permaculture and felt it had some value for Cuba. And so they made contacts with an NGO in Cuba. And then at this end, people worked through the Australian Conservation Foundation to develop an aid project in a partnership with the Cuban NGO. So that's how it all came about. The aid project itself is not going anymore, but I was in Cuba in November and I've been invited to work there on an eco-village concept in the coming year. And just at the moment, I think David Holmgren is either visiting there, so he's one of the co-founders of the permaculture concept. He's either there or about to arrive in Cuba and see what they've done over all these years.
Pam, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Pam Morgan. She's an Australian permaculturalist who's worked in Cuba. Thanks for joining us, Pam.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast to radios, iPods and computers around the world, like the one you're listening to now. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Melbourne, Australia. And now we're off to Nepal, where a whopping 90% of the working population depends on agriculture for a living. Chris Evans is the country representative for Appropriate Technology Asia, and he advises the Himalayan Permaculture Group. Chris, what type of advice are you being asked to give in Nepal?
Well, permaculture is very much about design based on observation, understanding of ecological processes, and farmers are very close to that in Nepal. There's a lot of knowledge about the soil, about the plants, about the climate, about biodiversity. Because they're close to that, then it is relatively straightforward to introduce new technologies, new approaches that help to raise the output of systems, because traditionally the farming in Nepal is quite high input in terms of labour. A lot of work goes into the farming, but relatively low output. So with permaculture, we look to sort of reverse that trend, make farming less hard work and less costly, but at the same time, through diversification and strengthening of natural resource base, we look to increase the productivity.
Of course, in Nepal, one of the big agricultural problems facing that country at the moment is the land degradation from all the tree felling. How is permaculture going to assist in that problem, Chris?
There's two things going on. One is that land is being cleared for farming, so forest land is what goes first when farmland needs to be produced. Secondly, the trees that they're clearing are actually crucial inputs for farming, so fodder, and leaf litter that go to provide inputs for the livestock, which produce the compost, which then goes on the land. So by clearing the forest to make new land, they're actually losing the resources that they need to maintain that land, if you like. So with design, by bringing trees back onto the land in farm forestry or agroforestry, as it's called, that is looking to increase forest resources actually on farmland.
I'm wondering what kind of priority permaculture's got in Nepal at the moment, given that there's been a huge amount of political conflict, violence in the country for many, many years now. What kind of priority are politicians, policy advisors, and indeed farmers themselves giving to permaculture?
Well, unfortunately, not enough. The situation is, in this post-conflict era, relief work is the priority now. Little work is actually going into long-term sustainable programs. Priorities remain the same. It's about people's health, educational capacity. It's about farming techniques to increase food security, because you have a lot of food insecure areas where young people that fled either to fight with the Maoists or to escape them are now coming back into the villages and finding that either nothing has changed or it's actually got worse. So we need to work with systems that, you know, increase livelihood opportunities in the villages.
And how are you framing this? I'm thinking, you know, working with young people, in some ways young people often think of agriculture as something that they don't want to invest a lot of time and energy into, but would prefer to do other things. Is it possible to recast agricultural endeavour in Nepal to make it, if you like, sexier through permaculture?
One of the things is obviously to make it more productive and less hard work. Those are two things that design is particularly able to do. Another is to diversify, and both in Nepal, India and China, where we work, there's poultry farming, there's mushroom farming, there's greenhouses. Permaculture is very much about diversification and about the linkages between different activities. Weaving is linked to farming, for example, because farmers are growing their own cotton, and we will demonstrate how to grow tree cotton, for example, instead of bush cotton. Bush cotton is an annual that takes a lot of inputs, a lot of regular weeding and yearly ploughing and irrigation, whereas tree cotton is a one-off crop. You plant it and then you just harvest it with minimal intervention. So there are lots of things that you can do. Another example is with the greenhouses. So the greenhouses that we build, not only in Nepal, in China, India as well, are passive solar, so they collect the solar gain, making the inside obviously warmer. They're built with rock on the back wall that absorbs the heat and lets it out at night. And apart from that, actually how the greenhouses are constructed, also the system of vegetable growing inside is designed to be a mixed cropping system that is ground covering, so it reduces the water need, it reduces weeds. So that's the sort of thing that's reducing the workload, but at the same time it's giving continuous outputs. We call it the polyveg system, and it's very, very productive.
And can I ask, too, one final question, Chris? How receptive are agricultural workers in Nepal to this?
They're understood very quickly because, like I say, the farmers and the agricultural workers, extension workers as well, are close to nature. These are sort of systems that are traditionally based on local resources anyway. So things are understood very quickly. At a policy level, things obviously take a lot longer. There's elements of competition, there's elements of external interference that says, well, actually, you need to be importing this fertilizer or these pesticides because that's what the companies say. But there is a growing trend now towards organic agriculture and sustainable agriculture. So it's good. The future looks good.
Absolutely. And you've just raised one point about not taking the fertilizers, for instance, from the big companies. Is that likely to create a problem down the track?
Possibly, but that can't stop the bus, can it? Farmers realize in Nepal that they have become dependent, especially in areas near the roads and the cities, that they've become dependent on these inputs, and they do destroy the soil. You ask any farmer who's had an experience of using chemicals, and that's what they'll tell you. And they say, well, but what to do? What can you do? How do you get off? How do you break the dependency? And so the sort of systems that we teach help to do that. They do move towards an organic and sustainable agriculture.
A terrific project, Chris. Thank you very much for joining us today. Chris Evans is the country representative for Appropriate Technology Asia, or ATA, in Nepal, and an advisor to the Himalayan Permaculture Group. So, Chris, for people who would like to read more about your work in Nepal, where would they go?
ATA has its own website. That's www.ataasia.com. all one word, .org.uk.
Good on you, Chris. Listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in 3CR Studios in Melbourne with today's co-host, David Ransom. David, permaculture is often associated with being a hippie. How come it gets such ordinary press?
Well, I don't know why the hippies are so disliked, I suppose. that's I was never a hippie, I should point out, or I lived through the hippie era. And it's really unfair in terms of how hippies are conceived, of withdrawing from the world and doing their own thing and living in a different lifestyle, and I suppose in their own way being a bit contemptuous of the rest of the world. Permaculture isn't like that at all. It's much more engaged with the world and consciously attempting to be so. And I don't believe through the course of doing the magazine I came across anybody who would conceivably be described as hippie, although perhaps they wouldn't feel it was an insult even if they were.
But it is a term that is designed to be diminutive, isn't it? It's designed to undercut the importance of permaculture and make it sound a little bit fringe, a little bit out there, a little bit left, therefore, you know, let's not engage with it.
Yeah, that's for sure. And maybe it's a bit of a problem, but I don't think a big one. I mean, it's more doing by example anyway. It's not going around and talking about it. It's about doing it. And the influence of that, I think, is going to be enormous.
How long do you think it will take for permaculture as a concept to enter the mainstream? You wouldn't say it's in the mainstream now, would you?
No, I wouldn't. And I suspect because the kinds of changes that we are facing, let's face it, within the next 50 to 100 years, we're going to be into major transformations of the way in which society operates. So I always sort of feel a bit reluctant to talk about moving into the mainstream or otherwise. I think the course of the mainstream is going to have to change one way or another. I'm not going to sit and wait for it to happen because I want it to happen anyway. And I think what we'll find is that it begins to merge, that it begins to become practically and in all sorts of other ways impossible to continue in the same way. And so people are going to actually reluctantly, perhaps at first, have to think of different ways of doing things. In the process, I think permaculture will have learnt a great deal more about how to engage with communities in a constructive way across a whole range of different situations. And gradually, I would imagine to see those two things coming together, not just permaculture, of course, but a whole range of other issues as well. And permaculture has an important, very important contribution to make.
Jonathan Dawson, who's the president of Global Eco Villages and a consultant editor to Permaculture magazine, has just dropped in for a chat. Jonathan, the people we're talking with today are painting the political potential of permaculture for us. Pam Morgan, who's worked in Cuba, was talking about saving fuel by growing close to the cities. And one of the results of that, of course, is that the supermarkets won't be happy with that. In other words, the big distributors of food within countries are not going to be happy about things that are practical, things that can save fuel, things that make sense for people's living arrangements when it affects their profits. What do you think will be the reaction of powerful forces within the community?
I think it depends if we're talking about permaculture light or permaculture for serious. Permaculture light, the way that most people understand permaculture, is primarily a locally based food production system. And as long as we stick to just producing food and being good boys and girls, they'll leave us alone. But real permaculture, I mean deep permaculture, is observing nature to derive sustainable design principles which affect everything, not just how we grow our food, but how we distribute our food, how we govern our economy, how we build our houses, how we do everything. Really, it's living bioregionally. It's finding a way of living from using building materials, using plants, using food, and on from within our own home local areas. Now, we have a global economy and a political elite devoted to it, which is all about creating a global market. So there is a clear contradiction between sustainable design principles and the current global economy and the political elites that have created it. So there is no question that we are talking within permaculture as a deep sustainability science is completely at odds with the current paradigm, the current global way of organizing our economy and society. So we are on collision course. I mean, I think that the reality is that as we move into a post-peak oil, peak energy situation, that we will be obliged to return to design principles for how we create our economies and our communities that will necessarily be more aligned to permaculture principles.
One of the things I'm struck by with permaculture is the principles themselves are so simple and so appealing because of their simplicity, working nature to help you, but also changing yourself to help nature, actually having a symbiotic relationship. It's a very easy concept. How come do you think that when people talk about permaculture, they use words like hippie?
I can talk about the European, specifically the British context. I'm speaking from Scotland. My feeling is that we haven't helped ourselves in that I think that many folk who have embraced permaculture, now I don't want to be critical here because it's a very important first step, but my feeling is that many of the people who have embraced permaculture have taken a little bit the attitude, stop the world, I want to get off. And so it's seen as a way of attaining some sort of independence from the system that they want no part of. And as I say, this is an important first step, but I think that the reality is that we can't build lifeboats that will sustain if the rest of society drops. And I think that the next step for the permaculture movement is to develop more affection for mainstream society and to build partnerships with people who are running community gardens, people who are working on sustainable projects, but within mainstream society, to bring the permaculture design principles on board so that we're beginning to stand shoulder to shoulder with the rest of society rather than looking from a distance and carrying some judgment against it.
One of the effects that permaculture can have on the political landscape is in reducing emissions. So it can be a really useful tool in combating things like climate change. We've just seen the G8 leaders make statements about climate change and the need for instance, words like carbon trading, carbon credits are becoming part of their political landscape and part of their solutions box. How do you read it at the moment, Jonathan? How does permaculture stack up against, for instance, carbon trading and carbon offsets?
Well, I'm sitting at the moment in the Findhorn Foundation community in the north of Scotland. We've just had our ecological footprint done. An ecological footprint is not quite the same as a carbon footprint, but they're pretty close. And as far as we can tell, the footprint that we've just had in is the lowest ever recorded in the industrialized world. It's about half the British average at about 2.7 hectares. It's around about half the average of mainstream society.
That's incredible.
It's a big achievement, and we've done that really by taking permaculture design principles and applying them to how we grow our food, how we build our houses. One little example here is that because we've got mixed-use planning, so we've got our residential and our commercial areas together, the study found that our car mileage was 6% of the national average because we're simply not commuting to work.
Yes.
So I think a very important dimension here is that we're not talking, as permaculturalists so often are, about individuals or very small groups trying to do this by themselves, but we're talking about a community. Here we have a community of close to 500 people, which is big enough that we've got our own community currency, it's big enough we've got our own community bank, it's big enough to generate businesses on site. So it's seeing that actually the community dimension is essential, that we cannot do this as individuals. So clearly, if we're talking about deep permaculture that is looking about the design of human settlements rather than simply food production, there is much that we can do. In terms of the other, what the mainstream is about with offsetting and carbon trading, I mean, I'm trained as an economist. My own feeling is that carbon trading is an important part of the equation. However, there are many problems with offsetting. I read in the paper just a couple of days ago that they believe that up to 20% of the offsets, particularly in India, are completely flawed. There's no additionality. In other words, these are projects that would have happened anyway. many other problems here. I think the biggest single problem with offsetting is that what is required is an unambiguous message that we need dramatically to reduce our carbon-related activities. And really, the offsetting message is muddying the waters. It's giving a confused message. It's saying that it may be okay. Now, I hear, for example, at the Paris-Dakar rally, I don't know if you've heard of it, a car race from Paris to Dakar in Senegal every year. This year it's carbon neutral, so-called. They're offsetting their emissions. So the message clearly is it's surreal. It's like a Monty Python sketch.
Yes, I mean...
But they're serious. They believe they're saving the planet by driving to Dakar. And this is the problem. I mean, I think that the various technical problems to do with measuring and certification can be resolved. This is not the weak point. The weak point is that it does exactly what the climate change deniers have done for the last decade. They've muddied the water by bringing doubt into the equation.
Absolutely. It's a very effective tool, isn't it? I mean, on this carbon trading scheme, though, it actually still gives you a license to do it, doesn't it? Whereas...
Well, I think that the carbon trading, certainly as the European Union has set it up, is not the solution, because we're simply giving the corporations huge amounts of money, and so far we've given them far more. It hasn't been a shrinking cap. We've actually, the European Commission issued more permits than the industries were previously even using, so completely mistaken. But if you look, for example, at contraction and convergence, this is the model developed by the Global Commons Institute in London, which I think really is the best global solution we have on the table. And here, it's a firmly shrinking cap. So you set a cap in emissions, and you shrink the cap by in the region of 5% a year. But by giving the same right to emit and the same monetary value associated with the right to emit to both people in the industrialized world and to people in the poorer countries, the economically poorer countries, and allowing some sort of trading between them, you see the cap shrinking, so the amount of carbon in the atmosphere will drop at the same time as there will be a net transfer of resources to the poorer people of the south. So it addresses both the emissions issue and the global inequality issue. And I think there is a place for it. I think there is a place for the market.
That's a good point to bring David Ransom back into our conversation. David, permaculture versus carbon offsetting, what's your view?
Well, I agree with a great deal of what Jonathan's been saying, but I'm probably a little bit more sceptical about markets and carbon trading and carbon offsets. I mean, there's just recently been quite a lot of disquiet in this country, that's Britain, about the European trading scheme, which has actually resulted in Britain in carbon emissions going up. And the reason for that is that because of the way the price mechanisms have worked, the power generators are switched from oil to coal, which has produced an increase, broadly speaking, is responsible for the increase in carbon emissions. So we have a carbon trading scheme at the moment which is actually increasing emissions. At the same time, the corporations who run those energy companies have made enormous, something like £1.3 billion, that's in excess of $2 billion of profits from emission trading. And
already?
They've added them just in 2005, actually, they made that amount of money. And there's still talk about the next round, which comes in 2008, where they're still even now not talking about what it will actually produce in terms of reductions in carbon emissions. So I think Jonathan was saying that he is sceptical about the European scheme, and I think with all good justification. And the other side of it, which I do agree with him about, is that it is about actually levels of consumption and just facing up to that issue. It's how much we actually consume. And that's got to be tackled by communities, by all of us, with a sense of urgency that is missing. And if we feel that it's being done for us by some kinds of elaborate schemes and billion-dollar deals which none of us have anything to do with, then it's not going to happen.
I'd really like to hear Jonathan's view on that. But before we go back to Jonathan, you've been casting an eye over a lot of different examples of permaculture operating around the world. How political do you think permaculture can be?
Well, I think it's getting a lot more political, and that's where I also agree that it's not a cop-out. Actually, it's not about withdrawing from society, it's about moving into it. And one of the most interesting offshoots from permaculture, because that's what it is what's known now as the Transition Towns Movement in Britain, which is just up and running. And that's moving right into mostly small towns, but also Bristol, the city near where I live, to look at what the future of a small town or a city might look like, or will have to look like, when the supplies of liquid carbon fuels decline. And thinking about it in all sorts of different ways, not just about food, but about the way people work, the way houses are constructed. You know, what will, say, a town like Totnes in Devon, which is always on the experimental forefront, what will it look like in 50, 100 years' time when there really are no liquid fuels? And it also pulls in things like people's own history. I think Totnes actually had its own currency at one time in the 19th century. So oral history and the extraordinary way in which societies have changed very quickly is also part of the equation. And I think that has an enormous appeal to people within their local communities and actually reinforces local democracy.
Jonathan Dawson, permaculture can offer something different, can't it? I mean, I was speaking to a permaculturist the other day who was saying, why not just make sure that the soil has more compost in it, humus in it, and that it's capable of growing more and actually giving rewards for that kind of project so that you don't have a scheme which still licenses people to actually emit carbon. What are your views about that, that positive incentive?
For sure, you're absolutely right. But once again, I'm going to move beyond the permaculture light of food production to look at the total package. And the total package is really predicated on the premise that if you observe how natural systems work and then apply those systems to all facets of our life, by definition, we're going to be happier. So just to give a little example, I was asked within the community, we had a conference recently on climate change, and I was asked to give a presentation, and really what I did was I showed slides of community life and said, this is the bitter reality of what a more permaculture-focused post-carbon future will be. And then I showed pictures of people having a lot of fun in community. So, I mean, so in other words, no more traffic jams, no more industrial crap in your fridge, no more lonely nights in front of the television. That the reality is that our addiction to fossil fuels has allowed us to build a society where we are separate from each other, and all our various things, our DVD players and all the rest of it, are paltry compensations for having lost the real thing, which is being an active and fulfilled member of a vibrant community. And there is no doubt that in many areas of life, quality of life will increase as our addiction to fossil fuels drops.
But this is the nub of it, though, isn't it? Because what you've just said is something that takes on the whole culture that has been built out there at the moment that is so helpful to selling products.
Absolutely, I completely agree.
So what discussions are being had at the moment about, if you like, how to sell that and how to protect yourself from the people who will attack it?
The dialogue with the mainstream is difficult because it really is speaking to one paradigm from within the mindset of another. So it is a difficult message to communicate. I think that one thing that certainly that eco-villages can do, the Findhorn Foundation where I'm living is an eco-village, and we have around about 3,000 people a year on training programs. And we also have a United Nations Sustainability Training Center. And it seems to me that the most profound and subversive message that we're actually communicating to all these people coming through is we're delinking what is really hardwired into the Western mind. We're delinking the connection, the assumed connection between economic growth and well-being.
Yes.
So one of the reasons we have only 6% of the national average car mileage is that we're paid so little. So we can't really afford to drive around in single occupancy cars, even if we wanted to. So people are coming and they're getting a direct experience of a community whose footprint is half the national average, whose level of material well-being is well below the national average, but which really, for the great majority of people, they come and they're blown away by the quality of life. So at that experiential level, we can really get the message across. I think increasingly eco-villages are building partnerships with local government, with local community groups, and the kind of experiments that we've been running for the last 3 or 4 decades around all this stuff is leaching out into the wider society. But at the level of political parties and engaging with the newspapers, it's a really difficult sell.
Jonathan, you're president of the Global Eco Villages Network. I'm wondering how large that network is at the moment and where your members are located around the world.
There are eco villages on every continent. We've got three regional nodes. The node for Europe and Africa is divided between Findhorn, where I'm sitting, and the Zeg community in Germany. There is a node called the Eco Village Network of the Americas, whose headquarters are in a community in Colorado. And there is Genoa, which is Global Eco Village Network for Oceania and Asia, whose headquarters are in the Crystal Waters Eco Village in Queensland. In terms of how many there are, it really depends on how many you count. So, for example, our biggest single member is an organization in Sri Lanka called Sparvodaya, and they work with 15,000 villages throughout the island of Sri Lanka. Now, similarly, in West Africa, we've got networks of several hundred villages working with Kolofifa and Gen Senegal. I would say that if we don't describe these networks as being, in the case of Sri Lanka, 15,000 members, but rather one, I would say that we have in the region of 500 eco-villages worldwide.
Wow. It's fascinating stuff, Jonathan. Thank you very much for joining us today. Jonathan Dawson is the president of the Global Eco-Villages Network and a consultant editor to Permaculture magazine in the United Kingdom. Thanks very much, Jonathan.
You're very welcome.
And keep us up to date with what you're doing. It sounds like fascinating work.
We'll stay in touch.
Week's musical interludes are from Renee LaSalle and Bob Brosman's Dig Dig, where the pulse of the Pacific melts into the arms of bluegrass and Latin. More about how to locate the CD later in the program, because you might want to buy it. And you're about to hear what Australian academic and author Sharon Bader thinks about buying bouts.
Do you feel overly preoccupied with shopping and spending? Do you feel that your shopping behaviour is excessive, inappropriate, or uncontrolled? Have your shopping desires, urges, fantasies, or behaviours ever been overly time-consuming, caused you to feel guilty or upset, or led to serious problems in your life, such as financial or legal problems or the loss of a relationship? These are questions that Professor Donald Black suggests in a recent paper in World Psychiatry that psychiatrists ask people whom they suspect of having CBD, compulsive shopping disorder. If you answered yes to these questions, you may have CBD and be in need of treatment. This is a disease that tends to strike people in their late teens or early 20s, about when they get their first credit card. Of course, if you are preoccupied with shopping and spending and regularly let yourself go and shop excessively, buying inappropriate items, but you're wealthy, then you won't feel so guilty about it and you won't land in debt or get in trouble with your significant other. CBD is a supposed medical disorder that discriminates. It only strikes at those who can't afford to spend freely. When Elton John spends £40 million in 2 years, he's not diagnosed as having CBD. Reading of the latest proposed sale of government assets, I realised that our politicians are perhaps afflicted with a complementary disorder, compulsive selling disorder. Here are some questions you might want to put to your local member. Do you feel overly anxious to sell off state assets? Do voters feel that your selling behaviour is excessive, inappropriate, or unwise? Have your privatisation behaviours or goals ever been overly optimistic or led to serious problems, such as rising or wildly fluctuating utility prices, unreliable public services, or the loss of environmental amenity? The difference between CBD, or compulsory buying disorder, and CSD, or compulsory selling disorder, of course, is that the individual and their family suffer the consequences of CBD buying, whilst the wider community suffers the consequences of CSD selling. And whereas CBD is said to affect less than 6% of the population, many of them women, particularly around Christmas time, CSD affects the majority of elected politicians, their economic advisers, and senior bureaucrats. Like CBD, CSD can negatively affect relationships, particularly the relationship between elected politicians and the people they represent. CSD-affected politicians are likely to ignore public opinion and even go ahead with sales that will lose them elections and lose government's money. The CSD impulse is so strong that politicians are often unable to delay their urge long enough for the appropriate research into possible consequences to be undertaken. They also tend to be in denial about the past experiences of other states or nations that have sold off similar assets before them. Treatment for CBD ranges from the use of antidepressants to cognitive behavioural therapy, but there is little evidence that current treatments are effective. To date, the only treatment available for CSD is shock therapy at election time. But we really should come up with something better because this is often too late and the damage has already been done. There are currently self-help books available for CBD, and if some bright spark, a recovered former politician perhaps, could just come up with a definitive self-help book for CSD-afflicted politicians, we'd all be much better off.
They were the thoughts of Sharon Bader about compulsive market disorders. Sharon's the author of Free Market Missionaries and Suiting Themselves, both published by Earthscan last year. And Rachel Maher was the reader. Well, time's up for today's Radio New Internationalist. And we just want to let you know that we're really enjoying this space, creating connections with people around the world, like you. Thanks as always to this program's associate producer, Rachel Maher, and thanks too to tonight's co-host, my friend and colleague David Ranson, who's a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine, who's just completed a magazine about permaculture, a very personal voyage of discovery about this simple but important practice. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. This week's musical interludes are from Renee LaSalle and Bob Brosman's Dig Dig, where the pulse of the Pacific melts into the arms of bluegrass and Latin. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again next week.